When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Hello and welcome. It's another weekend. We've come to Friday, and you've been tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. As promised, today we're going a little bit away from the supernatural and strange, but we're going to keep you on an amazing journey. As many of you have really enjoyed the different shows that we've done on forgotten cultures and forgotten parts of our history. And this is one of those episodes that I think is going to excite and entertain a lot of you. The book was brought to my attention again by one of our wonderful listeners. I want to thank all of you that listen and chime in on the show by sharing your ideas for guests and who you think would be great to feature and showcase on our show. A little bit later, we do have a brand new Theater of the Mind, and it's a creepy one, so make sure you stay tuned for that. But joining us for the remainder of this show, Maya Lynch was born on the west coast of Scotland. She has worked as a musician, designer, deckhand, and club promoter. She eventually trained as a computer programmer and worked for 20 years in the advertising industry, firstly as a digital creative promoting big brands, and then later as a strategist, advising politicians and NGOs. She is presently writing The Journey to the Heart of a Lost Empire series. Maya lives in New Zealand with her partner and their two dogs. Her book that we're here to discuss this evening is The Samoan Pyramid, the true story behind an extraordinary mystery, a forgotten pyramid, an ancient curse, and a real-life archaeological adventure. Welcome to the show, Maya Lynch. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you so much for asking me on. I'm thrilled to be here and so pleased that it was one of your listeners that recommended my book to you.
Well, it's always great, like I said, when they hear, and I think I even sent you the link to our Douglas Preston episode where we talked about the lost kingdom of the monkey god, and we had such a great response to that and other books of that ilk that listeners are constantly looking for this, and I wish I had the list up right now with the listener that referred you, but said, this is great. You guys are going to love this guest. The book is phenomenal. So I looked into it and it seemed to strike all the chords we're seeking, and you've been delightful to talk to off air. So I'm glad we were able to coordinate and do this. Now, I just read your varied history with different careers. How do you go from, I don't know, musician, designer, deckhand, and club promoter to world traveler and explorer, finding lost civilizations? What was that leap for you?
It was very strange, actually, Dave. And strangely enough, I just realized this afternoon that it was 6 years ago today that I embarked on this journey. So it's good timing, you know. So what happened was, so it was 2012, and I was a real, just a kind of working bee, you know. I was just a normal worker ant. And something really weird happened. I caught this thing that was called the swine flu. They called it the swine flu here. And it just makes you real sick. You get fever, all that kind of stuff. And in the middle of that fever, I had this crazy dream about being in Egypt on the Giza Plateau, you know. And when I emerged from that fever, I knew that that's exactly where I was going to go. And so a couple of weeks later, I ended up in Egypt, and the first pyramid that I went into, I met this guy, a young Egyptian guy called Yusuf Awiyan, and he kind of called me over to this one part in the pyramid, and he said, oh, listen to this. And he just started humming, like really quiet, just this little quiet tone. And within it, like 30 seconds, the whole place just started to vibrate and shake and kind of resonate, you know. And it was the most incredible thing I'd ever encountered. I mean, up until that point, like I say, I wasn't really interested in pyramids. I wasn't really interested in the supernatural or anything like that. And there I found myself in Egypt in the middle of a vibrating pyramid. And so I thought, well, I'm going to have to hang out with this guy. You know, he seems really interesting. And so, Yusuf, it turns out that his father was a guide on the Giza plateau, and so all the other guides on the plateau, they know Yusuf really well. So it turns out that he can, when you go with Yusuf, you can go places that nobody else gets to go, you know. And like, I remember one time we were walking into one area and the guard just lifted up the barbed wire and we crawled underneath. And so going with him, he took me into this, I don't know if you're aware of it, but on the Giza plateau, There's an entire network of tunnels and rooms and everything underneath the pyramids, and it stretches right across the plateau. It's absolutely incredible, and you know, shafts and all these kind of things that are underneath the pyramids, and you don't normally get to go in them, but we got to go in with Yusuf, and he showed me around, and it was, I mean, I can credit him really for a kind of a masterclass in what pyramids are all about. I'd gone there with the traditional view, it's a tomb and nothing more. And as we traveled around Egypt, I got this crazy education about things like, you know, the astronomical alignments, how the pyramids are perfectly aligned to certain stars in the north, south, east, and west. And then also, really interestingly, the role that water plays at ancient sites in Egypt. So all of the sites are built on top of aquifers, which is basically underground running water. And so the ancient people that built them selected these sites that were on top of an aquifer, and that's where they built their structures. And in some of the temples, there was one place called Abu Sir, which didn't have an aquifer underneath, but when you kind of looked underneath the paving slabs, you could see where the ancient builders had built in waterways to run underneath this temple to kind of, I guess, activate it or, you know, something like that. And so that, I mean, that was all real interesting. It was extremely mind-bending, you know what I mean, for someone who'd been really kind of quite closed off to all this kind of stuff. And there was one day, like, for instance, there was one day I was traveling on the bus and there was this woman who was saying mean things about somebody else on the bus, and it sounds completely crazy to say it, but I could see this kind of green vile thing coming out of her mouth. I could see this smoke coming out of her mouth as she was talking, and I mean, it was kind of shocking to me, you know.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I mean, like, and I wouldn't normally believe that kind of thing, you know.
Right.
but when you see it with your own eyes, what can you do?
That's a paradigm shifter.
Yeah, exactly, you know. And at the time, I kind of put it off to, oh, you know, everyone that goes to Egypt gets sick, you know. So I was like, oh, it's because I've been, you know, food poisoning and whatever. I'm just, you know, not kind of under the weather, you know. But then I went to this place called Philae Temple, which is probably the most beautiful place I've ever been to. And it's rumored that that's where Cleopatra had her kind of, had her home or her kind of love palace, you know, was Philae Temple. And as I walked through this temple, I just was astounded at the perfection of how beautifully it was built. And it was all built to the golden ratio, you know. So you walk through one space and then as you enter the next space, it's a golden ratio relationship to the space you were in before. And I mean, the whole thing, it's complete perfection, you know. And when I came out of that temple, I just sat down and I had a little cry to myself, because I'd never seen anything as beautiful. I'd never it wasn't just the way it looked, it was the way it felt. You know, I'd never really experienced anything like that, and I was completely bowled over by the place. And this old guy came over and sat next to me and said, "Oh, look, I understand exactly what you're going through, you know." And as we headed back on the boat, I noticed that all the couples that had come across to Philae Temple on the boat with us, all the couples were a little bit more loved up than they were on the way there. And I just started wondering if there was maybe something more, you know, if there was something more to these. I could certainly feel something happening to me. I could see it happening to the people around me as well. At least I felt I could, you know, that there was some kind of activation or something going on as we traveled around, you know, as we traveled around these sites in Egypt. And then one day, as I say, everybody gets sick when they go to Egypt. So I was sick this morning, and Yusuf's wife came and said, "Oh, come on, we're going to Karnak today. We're gonna see Sekhmet." And I was like, "Oh, I'm not really feeling so well." And she said, "No, of all the days, you have to come today." So I kind of dragged myself out of bed, and Sekhmet is this lioness goddess who, at one point, kind of lost the rag with humanity and got really, really drunk on wine and came down to the earth and killed everybody. That's kind of the story, you know, and they had to get really, really, really drunk till she fell asleep and she'd stop killing people. So she's this kind of, this mother figure, but a kind of vengeful mother figure, very powerful deity, you know. So the story was, we go into Karnak and they'd arranged this special access to this place called the Sekhmet Temple. We go into this place, and it's a small room, maybe, you know, 10, 15 meters square. I don't know what that is in feet. But it's about 10, 15 meters square, and in the middle of this place is this, I'd say, maybe 12 feet tall statue made of black basalt, of this goddess Sekhmet, this big lioness standing upright, you know. And a beam of light, just a single beam of light coming through this hole in the roof, pointing onto this statue. It's absolutely stunning. And I thought, well, you know, I'm glad I got up today. And Yusuf's wife said, "No, go on, touch her." And so I did. I put my hand on this statue, and all of a sudden, just as I touched her, this kind of wave hit me, and I was immediately transported. This sounds crazy. I understand it sounds crazy. I was immediately transported. I was in my mum's arms, and my mum was kind of cuddling me and holding me and saying, it's okay, you know. And my mum had passed 20 years previous, so it was quite overwhelming, you know. And then after a few minutes, she just went, "Okay, are you fine? You know, are you good?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm fine." And she goes, "And okay." And then she's gone, right? So I know it sounds nuts, right? So I walk outside, and I'm standing outside this temple, and again, I have another little cry to myself. I have another little cry to myself, and I'm standing there for about 10 minutes, and then this other girl comes out, and she's crying. And then 10 minutes later, this other girl comes out, and she's crying, and I start talking to them, and they all had, like, very, very similar experiences. They touched the statue, and something crazy happened, you know? And I couldn't really... You can't get beyond personal experience, you know. It's I can't explain it as to why that would happen, and I'm not saying that it was some spirit. I genuinely believe that there will be a scientific physiological reason for all these things, but the ancient Egyptians had built something there that has an incredible effect on people even today, you know, which is nuts, absolutely nuts, you know.
Well, it does seem that they were able to, pardon the pun, but encapsulate an energy, a real energy, something that was palpable, and you were able to experience something, and as were the other people that would enter. That's,
yeah.
I mean, to come from the life you led and suddenly have this yearn to voyage and see these miraculous things and go, and, I mean, you start seeing and experiencing things that were outside of your normal. Was that exciting? Was it scary? What was that like for you when it started to come together?
That's a really good question. I'll try and put my mind back there. Well, I'll say this. I mean, it was 6 years ago today that I first went to Egypt, and 6 years later, my life is utterly transformed for the better, you know? I'd gone from doing a job that I didn't really like, you know, just to make the money, and now to doing a job that I absolutely adore, and there's not great money in it, but there's always enough, you know? So I can say it worked out great that way, but I think at first, yeah, it's a little, when you see green smoke coming out of someone's mouth on a bus, you have to wonder what's going on, you know? It's like, what is in the water here? You know? It's,
and did you offer to hand over some breath mints for that?
Yeah.
What is the proper etiquette for that kind of situation?
I think just stay away, you know? I think just keep your distance. But it was crazy. And the great thing about it was, My one of my brothers had come along on the trip. He'd always been daft about Egypt, you know, and he loved Ali, you know, the whole ancient aliens thing, and he was crazy for Eric von Daniken and all that kind of stuff, right? So for him to see it through his eyes was amazing, you know. I mean, absolutely amazing for me, because I'd kind of written all of that off, and here it was staring me in the face that there was something really special going on here, you know, that it was not just a pile of old stones, you know. And there was one of the stories I heard when I was on the plateau. There's always people that tout for your business when you're on the Giza plateau, and they're happy to sit and talk with you, you know. And so this guy was telling me a story about Werner von Siemens, who's the Siemens Electrical Company guy, you know, and it was back in the 1850s, I think, that Siemens worked with. He was one of those early guys that understood electromagnetism, you know, and there wasn't many people on the planet at the time that understood that kind of thing. And so he was in Egypt, in Cairo, and he wanted to have this picnic on top of the Giza plateau, on top of the Great Pyramid, right? So they head off this morning, and they start climbing up the pyramid, making their way up the pyramid. And this great storm starts on the plateau, and within minutes, the whole thing is just encapsulated in this sand. You know, there's a big sandstorm going on. And as they're climbing up the pyramid, von Siemens says, at the time, I didn't really know whether I could believe the story of the guy that was telling me, but I actually found it in Werner von Siemens' diary later on and kind of verified it. So he says in his diary that he heard this remarkable hissing noise, which someone had pointed out to him, that when you raise your finger up in the air, you could feel like sparks on the end of your finger. So this guy, Werner von Siemens, he knows all about electromagnetism. He rushes up to the top and he grabs the bottle of wine out of his picnic basket and pours some of the wine on some newspapers, and then he wraps the newspaper around the wine bottle and holds that up in the air. Now, what he did when he did that was he created this thing called a Leyden jar, which is basically it's a kind of a capacitor, you know, an electric capacitor. So basically what you have is inside the wine bottle is wine that can conduct electricity. Then you have the layer of the glass, which doesn't conduct electricity, and then on the outside you have this damp newspaper that does conduct electricity, and that creates this a capacitor. And we use them in electronics today, you know. And so what a capacitor does is it basically stores energy, kind of like a temporary battery. So Siemens is holding the bottle up in the air, and basically as this storm rages around them, he's on top of the Giza pyramid, this wine bottle is getting charged up with electricity. And so one of his guides kind of starts to get a little bit worried about it and thinks there's some kind of magic or witchcraft or something going on. And he grabs at von Siemens, and von Siemens hits him with the bottle, and the guy gets electrocuted. He gets this massive electric shock from the wine bottle, and the whole party tear off down the side of the pyramid screaming, you know, magic, witchcraft, all that kind of stuff. It turns out, I wasn't sure at the time, but it turns out that it was a true story that actually happened to Werner von Siemens. So there's something weird, and this really opened my eyes when I was in Egypt, and then I stayed on and I met Robert Bouval, who's the guy that figured out that the pyramids are aligned to Orion's belt, and I traveled with him for a while, and then I met Christopher Dunn, who's the amazing engineer that has the concept that the Great Pyramid is a power plant, you know, in that great book, The Giza Power Plant. So I spent time with those guys. And so by the time I got back to New Zealand, my mind was buzzing with this stuff, you know. And so And there was nobody to talk to. There was nobody who wanted to listen to it, you know, really. But I knew this one guy. He was a video editor, and he worked for like National Geographic and I think the Science Channel and people like that. So he'd amassed this encyclopedic knowledge of the world, and I knew he'd be kind of he'd let me ramble at him, you know. And so one day I was with him and I was chatting about the pyramids, and it was him that first said to me, "Well, have you ever heard about the?" I was basically saying I was sad that there wasn't any pyramids in the South Pacific, you know. And he said, "Well, have you ever heard of the Samoan Star Mounds?" And I had to admit that I hadn't. And
the Samoan Star Mounds.
Yeah, the Star Mounds.
Okay.
And so they're not the pyramid that we're going to talk about. But they're kind of how I ended up finding out about it. But so the Star Mounds are basically they're built from stones, like rough laid stones. It's typically about a meter high, about 10 meters across, and shaped kind of like a starfish, you know. So that hence the name, the Star Mounds. In Samoan, they're called the Tia Sui Lupe, which means the pigeon grave. But the cool thing about the Star Mounds is that they were built only about 500 years ago was when they were kind of really in use. So they're ancient, but they're not that ancient. And they're certainly modern enough that the stories of why people used them, why people built them, all that kind of thing still exist in the folk tales today. So it's one of the few things in Samoa that the story exists and the monument is still there, you know? So what they used to do at these Star Mounds was they had some connection to the planet Venus, right? So basically, you know how Venus rises sometimes as the morning star and sometimes as the evening star.
Right.
It basically has this, I think it's like a 19-month cycle, basically, you know, that it goes through. So in Samoa, that when Venus rose as the morning star, so it's the brightest star in the sky just before dawn, just on the horizon, they would have these pigeon catching festivals, right? And everyone on the islands would decamp to the Star Mound, and they'd build these little huts on top, and the local chiefs would each compete to see how many wild pigeons they could catch with a net, you know. And it said that, nobody's really sure, but it said that maybe what happened, it was a kind of way of intermixing some tribes, you know, and intermixing families, because depending on how many pigeons you caught, you were able to take brides from another village and all that kind of stuff. But no, that's a hypothesis. Nobody's sure that's exactly what happened, you know. So they had these ancient Star Mounds, and you know, they're cool. The story's definitely cool. I love the fact that it's connected with Venus, but they're not ancient, you know. And they're when I've seen it myself, they're impressive, but they're not. It sounds terrible, but they're not hugely impressive. They're not massive, you know. Anyway, I thought, well, I'll humour my friend, and I downloaded a data set all about the Star Mounds, you know, and started digging into that data. And as I was going through the data set, it kind of classified all the different Star Mounds as some were small, you know, less than 10 metres, some were larger than 10 metres across, you know. And then there was this place called Pulemelei, that stood out in the data set because it was just massive compared to all the others. This thing was 60 meters across. So I think it's like, if you imagine a football field, if you imagine half a football field, it's the size of half a football field. You know, this thing is huge. And it didn't really fit the data. You know, it didn't really, it was weird. Everything else was, you know, starfish shaped. And then this thing is square shaped and like built like a step pyramid. And so I started looking at this place called Pulemelei, and I could see online, I could find some archaeological reports and some site plans and things like that. And there'd been an archaeological expedition there in 63. There was another one in 2002. And every one of them reported that it's spectacular. It's the largest monument in the whole of Polynesia. So it's big, you know. But no one knows who built it, right? Nobody knows who built it. Everybody said that in the reports. And that it's not only is it not in the history books, it's not even in the myths. And that's really strange for Samoa, because
right.
Samoa is steadfastly aligned to its past, you know, and there's not even a mention of who built it. And so
now, is
so
that you can imagine, is kind of looking around the world at different ruins and buildings like this or structures like this, are there some that have just been lost to the, you know, lineage of time? Nobody knows why they're there, who is around it. It seems to me we have a pretty good catalog of understanding where all of these structures originated from and the people that built them, even though it may be very light bits of information, there always seems to be some kind of historical record to back yeah. these stories up. Is this kind of an anomaly, the way this culture, this pyramid, this whole area seem to have just been forgotten?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, Dave. I mean, I don't know how much of an anomaly it really is, and that's, I think that's what's so fascinating about being alive right now, is that 10 years ago we might have imagined that everything had been discovered, and now we're realizing that, you know, with the use of that Douglas Preston interview I listened to when he's talking about using LIDAR, the laser visioning stuff that they used so they could look beneath the jungle, and they find a whole bunch of new stuff, you know? So I think there's a lot of stuff that I think over the next 10 years we're going to find, as LIDAR becomes less expensive, we're going to end up finding a whole bunch of new things to look at, you know? But yeah, in Samoa, it's there. Nobody knows who built it. There's no myth about it, which is just extraordinary. And and 2 weeks later, well, I wrote a little post-it note and just put it on my computer. There's a pyramid in Samoa and no one knows who built it, and just kind of left that sitting there on my monitor. And yeah, a couple of weeks later, I bought the ticket and I was on my way to Samoa searching for this ancient pyramid. And that's how it all began.
And wow, I love that. You're a go-getter. It's just like, yeah, you hear about it? No, let's go check this thing out. Now, you talk about a curse. How did that come? And I don't know if I'm jumping too far ahead in the story, but were you alerted to that up front, that there was a known possible curse associated to this? Or did that come later as you began digging deeper into the history?
Well, it was strange. When I got there, there was a definite resistance to anybody going to the pyramid. But the curse itself, I had no idea. You know, it's a thing called tapu, which is kind of, if something's tapu, it means it's forbidden. And tapu's the root of the English word taboo. That's where we get the word taboo from. So there's a, and it's a Samoan word, and that there's a definite darkness to this prohibition, you know. It's kind of demonic in nature. It sounds really weird, but it that's the threat. You break taboo, demons are going to come and get you. And there's the Scottish writer Robert Louis Stevenson. He lived in Samoa. He lived his kind of last years in Samoa, and he wrote in some of his letters about he'd seen people break taboo and then what happened to them, you know, and like they break a taboo and then there'd be 2 days of total fear, screaming. They'd be running around screaming, and then they'd be dead, you know. Or somebody else broke a taboo, and then they just faded away, sickness, and just died, you know. I honestly, if I'd known then what I knew now, there's no way I would have gone, you know. Just no way, no way.
Really? All right. Well, we don't want to force the story too quickly. We'll work our way there and get to it. This is great. So you decide you're going to hop on this plane. You're going to go investigate and check this out for yourself. Now, I mean, are they aligning some kind of guides for you, or are you just going to boots on the ground, hit the ground running, and start looking for people to help you once you get there?
Well, that was the plan, you know. And to be honest with you, I mean, I was completely naive, you know. I hear you giggling.
Well,
you
yeah, know? Because I can't go down the block without getting my GPS and asking my wife for help and leaving breadcrumbs because I get lost that easily. So I just, to me, it's amazing that you're just like, oh, interesting. All right, I'm on my way, and there's nothing set for you. You're just going to go try to seek this lost culture nobody talks about. There's barely rumors about, but it's enough to inspire you to make that trek. That's amazing in itself.
Thank you. I mean, that's the thing. I'm a great believer in curiosity being a driver, you know, and kind of self-directed learning, and always have been. It's whatever interests you is what you should be studying, you know. And the only problem with living a life that way is that your career tends to jump all over the place, because after you've learned something, you're not you're not curious about it anymore. You want to move on to the next thing that makes you curious, you know. But that's just the way I am, you know. And also, I've traveled a lot, and I've got great faith in humanity, you know. I just believe in the goodness of people, and so far they haven't let me down, you know. There's been one or two, but, you know, in general, it's a much safer world out there than you might think, you know. Anywho, So I get some. I'll just kind of set the scene a little bit, so people know where we're talking about, you know, because I think some people don't know where Samoa is. So Samoa's in the Pacific Ocean, and it's kind of right in the center of the Pacific. And the Pacific is, I mean, it's vast. You could take every country on the planet, put it in the Pacific, and you'd still have room for more. It's that big, right? Absolutely huge. Now, right in the center of this place, just below the equator, you've halfway between China on one side and South America on the other side, you have this chain of eight volcanic islands called Samoa. And four of those islands, they belong to America, or they're kind of an American protectorate, and four of them are independent Samoa. It's just used to be called Western Samoa. It's called Samoa now. And the island that this pyramid on is one of those islands in independent Samoa called Savai. And it's just, if you imagine, you know, palm trees, idyllic paradise, remote tropical island with a volcano on it, that's exactly what you get. You know, it's so incredibly stunning.
I can imagine stories, it. Only in my imagination, yeah. There are giant dinosaurs running loose, and nothing good ever comes from these kind of places.
That's exactly how I felt when I first saw it. I said, oh, my God, it looks like Jurassic Park. Right. Honest to God. You know? That's what it looks like, right? And absolutely stunning. It's so beautiful that there's stories of when in the 1800s, when the whaling ships would sail past, the sailors would just jump ship and swim to shore, you know? And other stories of shipwrecked sailors who refused to be rescued from the island. It's paradise, you know? It's absolutely paradise. And so you were asking that when I got there, did I think that some, you know, did I have any guides or anything? I genuinely believed that I would get there, I would take a tour bus, I'd see the pyramid, and then I'd spend the rest of the week on the beach, you know, waiting for the flight out. I really thought it was going to be that easy, but that turned out I was really, really naive. You know, it wasn't anything quite as easy as that at all.
It never is, right?
Yeah, it never is, you know. So I went to the tourist office and was told, no, there's no guides, there's no bus, there's no nothing. I asked around and people were like, nah, nobody wants to take you there. And then, you know, it's obvious now that there's a curse on the place, a taboo put on the place, which means they couldn't help me even if they wanted to, you know. So that's where we got to.
Well, was that a little disheartening to get there and get that kind of attitude, or did you just... did that inspire you even more to start digging deeper? Because obviously if people aren't willing to go there, aren't willing to help you, that there's one of two reasons. It doesn't exist, or they know more than they want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, when I asked around, most people had never heard of it. Even so, on the island that this pyramid is on, most people had never heard of it. And people in Samoa are real friendly on the whole, and so, you know, people would say, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I'll ask my grandparents, you know, and then I'll come and see you. And they'd come back and, yeah, it exists, but you can't go. And that was kind of the typical answer that I got over and over again. And eventually I just got to the point where I thought, well, I've come this far, you know. I'm just going to give it my best shot and go and find this place. You know, that was the plan. Kind of halfway through the trip, I thought, well, if nobody's going to help me, so be it, and I'll just find it myself. It was a kind of dumb move. But eventually, eventually, I met this real nice woman who I asked her if she'd ever heard of Pool MLA. Basically, what happened was I was swimming in this next to this waterfall with some friends, and it just had this synapse go off in my head of the water was... the water was seeping through the cliff face. It wasn't kind of pouring over the cliff face. It was seeping out of the cliff face. And it just pinged in my brain. I was like, oh, my God, that's an aquifer, just like in Egypt. And I thought, my God, if that is an aquifer, that's where that pyramid is. You know, I just put those two things together and I just ran down the street, found the first house I could, went in and asked them if they'd ever heard of a pyramid around there. They thought I was crazy, but they had. One of them had, and one of them agreed to be my guide and take me to the pyramid, you know? So that's luckily how the whole thing really got started.
Now, I've got to ask you, we've got a lot of wannabe intrepid explorers that are listening to the show right now. And they're suddenly going to be convinced that they can just jump on a plane and head to some foreign land, poke around a little bit, and some kindly guide is going to eventually help them. Is there, I mean, I you know, certainly I understand a lot of this is private, but I mean, is there a lot of money that goes into an expedition like this and trying to get somebody to lead you and take you where you want to go?
That's very funny, because when I listened to the interview with Douglas Preston, it was when he said how much they'd spent, and that's great because they have it, you know.
Right.
I think it was $1 million on the LIDAR research, and then maybe another $1 million or maybe two on top of that. This was, I mean, nothing like that, you know. I mean, this was totally bootstrapped. It was, I think, in total over the whole week, I spent less than 1,000 New Zealand, which is probably about 700 American. So really, nothing. You know, I mean, well, not nothing. I mean, it's not no money, but it's not millions of dollars, you know. So I would say to your listeners, it may be irresponsible of me to say it, and I don't mean that. If you're not a good traveler, don't try it. But if you can go out and be sweet with people, but not stupid. Never be stupid. You know, I mean, never kind of let your guard down. Never let somebody talk you into something you don't want to do. But if you can be sweet with everyone, then travel, you know. I mean, definitely, it's the best thing you can do, you know. And I genuinely believe that if you have that call to adventure, then there's nothing better you can do than answer it, you know.
All right. Well, you heard it. Maya knows better than I do. My call to action and adventure is getting to the end of the driveway to get my garbage cans back up on an icy day. Let's do this. We need to take a break. Before we do that, we're going to open up the dark hives. We wanted more dark and scary. You guys have been asking for it, so we're about to deliver on this, a brand new edition of Theater of the Mind. This week's Theater of the Mind is a real-life experience from Joseph Buttich. Life imitating art. Back in 1979, when I was just 10 years old, CBS ran a miniseries called Salem's Lot. My mother and father actually left me and my younger brothers home alone with a couple of our friends, while they went up the street to visit my grandmother, who was just a block away. It was a different time then, and it was a safe neighborhood, so I can't fault them for trusting us alone. Of course, with them gone, we all opted to watch Salem's Lot. We made it through the show without incident and went upstairs to play. After a little while, my younger brother started screaming and I ran into his room. I asked him what was the matter, and he said he heard somebody scratching on his window. His friend Steve agreed with him. I called them both chickens and I told them to settle down or I was going to get in trouble for letting them watch that movie. I knew they were just thinking of that vampire kid scratching on his friend's window to let them in, and I wasn't going to take a beating because they were wusses. I might have thought my younger brother, James, was trying to scare them by scratching on the window, but I knew that there was no way he could climb up onto that particular second floor window, so I just chalked it up to them being scaredy cats, and I still do. The night got later, and I knew my parents were up the street playing cards. They always came home late when they did that. So I told everyone they could sleep downstairs in the living room, so no one would get up in the middle of the night screaming that a vampire had tried to bite them. I'm not sure what time it was, but I knew it was before 2 a.m., but sometime after midnight that there started a light knocking on the front door. The living room was adjacent to the hallway, and that led to the front door, and you could look out one of its windows onto the porch. We had a window by the front door, but it was stained glass, and you couldn't see out if you wanted to. The door itself had a frosted-style window that only let you see shadows, but not who was on the other side. I had awakened pretty quickly. I mean, I might not be chicken, but at 10 years old, if you're alone in a house with no parents and had just watched a creepy-as-hell vampire flick, Your heart tends to pound pretty hard at the slightest noise. The knocking was fairly hard, but not rapid. Just a knock. 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 Which would start again after about a few minutes. I got up pretty slowly and went to the door. "Who is it?" I asked. The knocking stopped. And again I asked, "Who's there?" Now at this point, I was in a quandary. I couldn't look scared or I'd never hear the end of it. And I couldn't open the door because I didn't know who it was. That was when a girl's voice said,
"Let us in. We are cold."
Now, the girl sounded like she was about my age or maybe a little older. I could just make out the outline of the top of her head through the door window. She was just slightly taller than me. That was when Brock, my other stayover friend, called from the living room. "Hey, bud, there's two girls at the door." I said, "What?" He replied that there were two girls out there in shorts and tank tops, and they didn't look cold. Then he said, "I think they're vampires." Now, we knew the lore. Vamps had to be invited in, and here we were with two girls we didn't know, and we knew every kid in our neighborhood. They were dressed like they were on a summer outing in the middle of a snowy November. Of course, he said vampires. Of course, I thought vampires too, but I wasn't going to admit it. "Shut up," I said to Brock, and then I turned to the door. "Who are you?" I asked.
"Cold,"
came the reply.
"We are so cold. We need in. Can we come in?"
Brock said they moved weird, and I should come see them. I left the door and went over to the curtains to look out. I asked Brock what he was talking about and how they moved. He said that they didn't shiver, and they weren't rubbing their arms. They just stood at the door, very still, like they were trying to look inside. I pulled aside the curtain to look out, when I was met with the face that almost pressed against the glass window. She was peering in. All I could see was that her eyes were jet black. Then I also noticed that I couldn't see her breath. She wasn't fogging up the glass, and she didn't have any wintry steam issuing from her mouth. She was like a glassy-eyed statue that moved. Her skin was light, but not pale, and I remember she had dark hair. She looked about 12 years old. All I know is, I couldn't look away. It was like I was in a trance. I remember thinking over the years that vampires really could bedazzle you. You know, hit you with some kind of weird mind control, because I really felt like I was not in control of my body. If Steve hadn't started crying and knocked the curtains from my hand, I don't know what I would have done. I just might have opened that door and let them in. Once the window was covered and I recovered my wits, I yelled that I was calling the police. "You better get out of here, or I'm going to call the police." I got everyone upstairs into my parents' room and closed the door. My parents arrived just a touch after 2 a.m. and wanted to know why we were all in their bed. My brothers blurted out that vampires had come to the door and tried to get us, and instantly, they knew we watched Salem's Lot. I was grounded for about a month, but it was a winter, so it wasn't that big a deal. We never forgot how we were visited by vampires on that cold November night. After hearing your show, I started thinking that this sounded a lot like black-eyed kids that you talk about. I have to admit, I never did see any fangs, but I sure as hell saw black eyes, like the demons on TV. I have to say that I now lean toward the probability that there are no vampires, but that there are those creepy black-eyed kids roaming amongst us.
Beyond the Darkness.
Hello, welcome back to the show. Remember, I will be hosting Coast to Coast AM this Saturday and Sunday. I hope you'll join me. 4 hours each night, Saturday from midnight till 4 a.m. Central, Sunday from midnight till 4 a.m. Central, and we've got a great slate of guests popping up. You can check out coasttocoastam.com for more information and to find stations and times in your area and ways to listen to the show. You can also listen to it live simply by downloading the KNSI Radio app, and there you'll be able to find it. And that's our home station here in St. Cloud, Minnesota for Coast to Coast AM. And you can stream it right from their website. You can stream it right from their app. It's available and out there, so go check that out for yourself. But again, this weekend, Coast to Coast AM, I'll be hosting both Saturday and Sunday night. Tonight, a forgotten pyramid, an ancient curse, and a real-life archaeological adventure. The Samoan Pyramid, the true story behind an extraordinary mystery. Maya Lynch, our guest. I've got the word pyramid keeps hanging up in my mouth for some reason. I want to keep imperium on me. I can't get the word out tonight. Maya, thank you for joining us and sharing this unique story with us. It's fascinating to hear this.
Thank you, Dave. I'm really enjoying. I hope I'm not boring your listeners or sound like a crazy old lady. You know what I mean? But
not at all. So be it. This is fascinating. All right. So, set the scene for us. For people that have lost their mind for a few minutes because of Theater of the Mind and the commercial break. Bring us back. We're Samoa. You're on this beautiful set of islands. There's eight islands, and there is this whispered about kind of exotic idea that there are pyramids or a culture there that has vanished and that nobody is aware of anymore. And you've decided to take it upon yourself to fly there, find a guide, and set out to find this. Am I right? I mean, this we're all caught up to date on that?
Yeah, pretty much. That's pretty much what happened. So nobody on the island was really keen to talk about it or knew what I was talking about apart from one old guy, this old Hawaiian guy that I met, who kind of, I think, took pity on me and showed me a map. And he showed me this map that he'd kept since the 70s. He'd met this guy who'd actually drawn the map. And so when this guy Noah, when he showed me the map, he basically, we were in the bar and he just laid it on the table and he said, this is the city. And he showed me there's this ancient city that kind of stretches out throughout the jungle, this abandoned ancient city. And that the pyramid was at the kind of innermost, at the top of this city. And that's kind of, if I wanted to get there, that's where I had to get to. And so as we said before the break, I just kind of found someone who was willing to go in the jungle with me. We went back the next day and off we set, you know, with my guide Baba. And so we kind of walk along the main coast road. So in Savai, on this island, everybody lives around the coast, around this called the coast road. Everybody lives around the coast road and nobody lives in the interior of the island, which is all jungle and volcano.
Can I ask one thing before we go too deeply? Sure. So with this guide, is the guide kind of tongue-in-cheek, willing to just take you to earn a few dollars? Or was there some excitement on their part to actually go in and look for this and perhaps find this lost civilization?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, I didn't know the guy. The only experience I'd had of him before was kind of weird. It was when we were swimming in the next to the waterfall. He was hiding in the bushes watching us all. So when it turned out to be him that was going to be my guide, I was kind of in two minds about it, you know?
Right.
I was like, this guy might be a little bit creepy, but at the same time, he's the only guide that's going to take me, you know? So I kind of weighed that one up very quickly in my head and thought, do I go, do I not go? And I came down and decided that I go, which is maybe not great advice. It's not advice I'd give to anyone else, but that's what happened, you know? So yeah, so he was doing it. Sure, he was doing it for the money. He knew a lot about it, though. I mean, he lives quite near there, and he could answer. You know, he showed me one of the star mounds. It was him that told me all about the Venus correspondence with the star mounds and those kind of things. He knew a lot about the kind of more recent history of the area because there's the whole area is in this land dispute. Does the land belong to the local villagers? Does it belong to the company that this Swedish company called the Nelson Corporation that have claimed ownership of the land that this pyramid sits on. So he knew all about that kind of stuff. So I think he was excited to have someone to tell about, you know, those stories, someone that was interested in them. But I was all dressed up in my explorer clothes, you know what I mean? And he wasn't, you know what I mean? He was kind of in jogging pants and that kind of thing, you know? So looking back, we were extremely unprepared, and I think I'm pretty sure that's where the other $2 million goes when you're mounting an expedition. We were just kind of winging it, you know, to be honest. So anyway, we head off from Baba's village. We head out on the coast road, and we're walking along for a while, and we pick up some bottles of water, and we keep heading, and then he goes, "Oh, look, there's the sign." And at first I couldn't see it, and it's about the size of a matchbox. There's a tiny, on one of the palm trees, there's a tiny little wooden arrow, nothing written on it, hammered on this palm tree. And he says, "There it is, this is where we go in," you know. So we jumped in the jungle, you know, jumped over this big drainage ditch and then into this tall grass, and the grass is taller than me, you know. And we're kind of walking through that, and then we come to this river that we have to kind of go across the stepping stones and get across the river. And then almost straight away, as soon as you're on the other side, as soon as you get up the bank on the other side of the river, you're at the start of the city. And it's incredible. Like, there's cobbled roads and stone platforms and stone walls and all these kind of things that are just built. You know, the jungle's closing in, and gets real hot and wet and everything. But and I really found out I really don't like the jungle. It's not a pleasant place to be, you know.
Why is that, Maya?
It's just really hot, you know.
What about the creatures? Is there anything out there that wants to eat you?
There's some spiders and things there, but there's nothing. There's no alligators or anything, you know. I mean, on Samoa, it's just pretty safe that way, you know. But there's it just was like, you can imagine, you're walking up a mountain in the jungle, it's roasting hot, it's soaking wet, you know what I mean? And you're kind of just plowing through this stuff, and it's, you know, you're stepping over logs, and then you're cutting down a bit, and you're pushing through this bit and climbing over that bit. And I think the distance we traveled, I mean, it was only a few miles tops, but it took hours and hours and hours and hours, you know, because you're just, it's constantly hacking away at things, and then you'll kind of push your way through some vines, and you'll come out, and you know, there you're rewarded by this incredible stone wall that, you know, maybe nobody's seen for hundreds of years. And it's just, it's incredible. It's proper Indiana Jones type stuff, you know. It's exactly what you would wish it to be, you know. Really amazing, you know. So we're pushing through this, and then heading up this mountain up to the volcano, because this pyramid is on this mountain on the edge of a volcano, which is just, I mean, why would you build something there, you know? It just sounds crazy, but they did, you know. And then you get to this point where we nicknamed it the cathedral, because it was this, it was just absolutely stunning natural formation of the way the trees and everything grew around it. Had kind of created this space like an ancient basilica, you know. It was this kind of golden ratio arch 30 meters up above us, and all the cicadas were screaming and all this kind of stuff, and it just felt magical, you know, absolutely stunning and magical. And then just when we departed that point, we're kind of walking through the jungle, and I kept kind of losing Baba. He was kept pushing ahead, and I was kind of struggling to keep up with him, and I just...
The guide does realize the job is to guide you, not to leave you behind, right?
Well, I'm not too sure, because just when I was about to shout out, this other guy, just appears from nowhere, right? Just in the middle of the jungle, this guy, he's got a machete hanging from one arm, he's got an AK-47 over his shoulder, and it all just kicks off, right? So Baba's... Like, he turns around and he's screaming at the guy. The guy's screaming at him. They're talking to someone. I can't understand a word they're saying, you know. But I can tell that it's not good. You know, it's pretty obvious. This is descending into some chaos pretty quick. And so I just started talking about the pyramid and saying anything I could think of with the word pyramid, and just talking about how I've come all the way to see this pyramid and I really want to see it, and blah, 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 and blah, 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 like that. And eventually this guy with a gun kind of, you know, softened, kind of relaxed, and stepped back and kind of looked at me like he was bemused by the whole thing, and said, "Yep, on you go. You can go. You know, go to the pyramid. On you go, young lady." And so I was absolutely gobsmacked. I mean, I really didn't expect anything like that, you know. And so we walked for another half an hour. We didn't say a word to each other. And eventually, I was like, "What? Who was that guy? You know, what was that all about?" And that's when Baba told me about there was this this land dispute. So the people in his village say the land belongs to them because it's next to their village, you know. But what happened was in the 1800s, this Swedish guy, Olaf Nelson, had arrived in Samoa, he'd married a local girl, and the land was given to him as a dowry, you know. And what Baba was explaining to me was that in Samoa, ownership, it's not like Western ownership. You own it, but to own something means you need to look after it, you know. And as soon as you stop looking after something, you no longer own it. The two things are intimately connected, you know. And so when Olaf Nelson died, the Nelson family inherited the land, but they didn't look after it. The plantation shut down. There's no work for the people to do. So the local villagers basically said, you know, either buy the land off us and, you know, buy us out, or give the land to us so we can work it and at least make a living from it. And neither of those things were allowed to happen. The whole thing went to court in 2010, and the judge threw the case out and basically made it illegal for the local people to go onto the land and to the pyramid. And that's when I realized that that point that we were trespassing.
Jeez.
Okay. You know, in for a penny, in for a pound, you know what I mean? Let's carry on, you know? So we're kind of walking along a little bit further, and we'd been walking on this kind of cobbled road for a long time. And then we got to this point where the feel under your foot definitely changed. And I could tell that this was, like the slabs were much bigger than the little cobbles we'd been walking on. And when we kind of cleared the leaves away and had a look, you could see that it was this incredible, they call it a fitted floor. So where every piece is intricately cut to fit the piece next to it, kind of like a jigsaw puzzle, you know? Mm-hmm. And every pyramid I've seen at has that, you know? It's all on the Giza Plateau, surrounding the pyramids on the Giza Plateau, all the floors are intricately cut so that they fit together like that. And I've heard the theory that it makes them earthquake resistant. It makes them, they don't break apart when things vibrate, whereas if you have a very kind of homogeneous floor, it would crack and break when forces go through it. So I had this sense that if it's a fitted floor, we're getting close, you know. We're in a high status area. This is definitely they don't do this for the proletariat, they do this for the priests, you know. This is a special place. And so we're just kind of getting there, and then Baba kind of pulls these vines, kind of sweeps these vines aside, and boom, there it is. The pyramid just kind of fills your field of vision, you know. It was absolutely gobsmacking, because I never thought I was going to get there. But I was overwhelmed with this experience of this massive pyramid in front of me, and it's all overgrown with the jungle, and it's an absolutely stunning sight to behold, but difficult to comprehend, because you can't get any sense of the scale of it. You've kind of, the jungle pushes you right up next to this thing, so you're right next to it, really hard to figure out kind of where the ends are and, you know, what's what, you know. It's kind of not like you would see in the picture books. I took some photographs, but it's almost pointless because it just looks like jungle, you know. I mean, it's only because you're there and you're poking it that you can tell it's the actual thing. And so, like I said, it's about 200 feet square and about 40 plus feet high, and it's built in three steps. It's with a flat top, you know. It's all overgrown, like I said, with the jungle. And then it's built from basalt stone, which is big volcanic rocks, and cut into the eastern and western sides are these stairways. They're kind of more like ramps really than stairways, cut into the eastern and western sides of the thing. And then 50 meters to the north, I knew that there was another smaller structure connected to the main pyramid with a raised walkway, a raised stone walkway, but there wasn't. I couldn't even see that smaller structure. I couldn't even see 50 meters to the north. I couldn't see anything like that far, you know. And we tried pushing through the jungle to get to that point, but it was just too thick. We couldn't get any further north than we were. And the whole thing is aligned to the cardinal directions, just like every pyramid. You know, the whole thing is aligned north, south, east, west. You know, it's got these eastern and western stairways which align to the rising and setting sun on the equinox. And so we raced our way up the stairways, you know, we're kind of sprinting to beat each other up the stairways that we'd finally got there and arrive at the top. And for the first time, we're out of the jungle for the first time in hours. It's kind of fresh air. You can actually see something other than trees, you know, and it brings you above the jungle canopy. So you get to look out over the island, over where the ancient city is, and all the way kind of out south, looking out across the Pacific. An absolutely stunning view, you know, and I remember thinking at the time it would make an incredible observatory, you know, it would make an incredible stellar observatory. I'm sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought there, Dave.
No problem. You're just talking about kind of coming upon this amazing structure and how it's that had to be just overwhelming. And once the people in that area, the guy with the gun, they knew about this, right? So this wasn't such a hidden secret, but it was a protected secret. Is that maybe a better way to say it?
Yeah, that's definitely what it felt like, you know, that there was, I think your kind of average punter isn't going to know anything about it, but there are certainly people that know everything about it and are protecting it, you know. I wondered maybe the guy with the gun was doing, you know, doing an illegal still or something in the jungle and we just happened upon it or whatever, you know. I mean, who knows what he was doing, but it was quite the adventure bumping into him. So we clamber up to the top and we jump around. We're all celebratory and excited to be there and everything. And Baba's starts telling me about the name Boulamelei, the name of the pyramid, which the archaeologists translate as high place of the chief. And Baba told me that it's just lazy. You know what I mean? It's the worst translation. It's nothing close. So yeah, I know. So he says the Boulamelei sound is the conch shell that I don't know if you'll have seen in kind of any Polynesian ceremonies that they'll blow the conch shell to kind of awaken the people and the spirits and all that kind of thing. And when you have, I was at a wedding with some Maori friends of mine, and I'd only ever heard one conch shell being blown at a time before. I'd only heard the one, and it's an arresting sound when you hear one of them. It kind of vibrates. But when you hear more than one, you get this crazy kind of feedback standing wave distortion thing that just emerges, you know what I mean, from amongst them all. It's like this resonant sound that kind of, and you really feel it going through you. It's like an electric charge, you know. So that the name, it kind of connects it with the conch shell. And then Lemelei, the second part of the name, means power. So they were kind of right, the high place of the chief. It means power. But it's not like any power wielded by man. It's the power of the universe, you know. It's this all-powerful power, you know. And so when you think of the name like that, of the kind of the conch shell and the sound and the vibration, and then this power of the universe, it really conjures up something. Is something kind of, in my mind, something electric, electromagnetic, something kind of strong
powerful,
and powerful,
right,
like
sure.
that. Yeah. So Baba told me that, and then he took off to, like I said, the whole thing's overgrown with jungle, so he took off to the kind of southeastern corner when there's a banyan tree that's grown right through the pyramid, in the southeastern corner. He took to have a little sleep over there, and I started going around measuring and, you know, trying to look for things that I'd seen in archaeological reports about the place, like sort of certain post holes and certain cairns and certain markers and things like that. And then strangest things started to happen was that I started to struggle with my breathing, and you know, I was find it really hard to breathe, and I'm not the fittest person, so that in itself is not a great shock. You know what I mean? I was kind of struggling to breathe a little bit, a little bit frightening, but okay. But then I started getting these strange, like, flashes of light. I was looking and I could see, like, you know, that purple and orange light inside my eyes, kind of pulsing, and it was really, really strange. And it was kind of all coupled with this growing sense of dread, this kind of increasing sense that something was about to go horribly wrong, you know. And it was really disconcerting. And I remember, I was trying to measure the pyramid, and then I remember I took my compass out, and as I was walking around, when I stood in the middle, the compass read fine. It read exactly the north, south, east, west, everything was fine. But as soon as I left the center, it would start going kind of crazy and pointing in directions that I knew were completely not right, you know. And it never occurred to me at the time that it was something electromagnetic, that something weird was happening, you know. But as I say, I was walking around, I had these kind of, as soon as the kind of flashes of light stopped, I'd convince myself it was imagining it, or, you know, it was just that I hadn't drunk enough water or something like that.
Sure.
As soon as I convinced myself everything was going to be fine, boom, they'd start again, right? And so this went on for hours, you know. And eventually I said to Baba, look, I think I've probably had enough, you know what I mean? I think I need to go. Because it was just rising fear, you know, I mean, I really thought I was going to die, you know. And I know that sounds bonkers, but that's what it was. And for the longest time, I had no idea what had caused it or what it was really about. But I was convinced that there was going to be some scientific explanation, because I really wasn't prepared to consider that I'd gone completely crazy on top of the pyramids. You know what I mean? That was not something that I was willing to entertain. So I had no idea kind of what the answer was, and I kind of went down this rabbit hole of research and strange ocular phenomenon, things like the prisoner's cinema, where if you lock someone in a darkened room after a certain length of time, they'll start imagining crazy, they'll just start seeing real figures. And you know, it took me down this rabbit hole that was really nothing to do with what I was trying to research, and I spent months learning about weird ocular phenomena anyway. And then one night I was listening to an interview with this guy called John Burke, who was this biological engineer from Boston University. And he was just like this kind of clean-cut scientist, soft-spoken, nerdy dude, you know. But he researched things that most biological engineers don't. He looked at ancient sacred sites, and he'd been to Stonehenge and Tikal in Mexico and the Dolmen Mounds, and all over the world he'd been to all these different places, and measuring electromagnetic energy at these different sites, you know. So he'd go with magnetometers and all these different cool machines that he could measure stuff. And he was a real kind of sober, straight guy, right? So I was listening to this interview, and he was saying that he didn't like to use the word sacred, because he believed that in most cases there was a physical purpose and a physical action that occurred there, more so than a spiritual one, you know. And I thought, well, this guy's on my wavelength, you know, I can understand where he's coming from. I feel kind of the same myself. Anyway, he was talking about how he went all around the world with these magnetometers and electronic equipment measuring these different things. And the interviewer asked him if he'd ever experienced anything strange when he was at one of these sites. And he said everybody always asks him that, but he hadn't. He's not really of that mindset. And he's usually, you know, it's his job to be there taking the readings, and so he's in a different mindset. And then he kind of paused, and he said, well, there was this one time, the first time I went into one of those rock chambers, he said, one of those dolmens, I was repeatedly crossing magnetic field lines during the course of the day. And well, by the end of the day, I thought I was going to die. I actually feared for my life. And when I heard him say that, I actually feared for my life, I totally got it. I totally got what he was talking about, you know. I was just kind of, that's exactly what happened to me on Pool MLA. My compass was going crazy here and there. I just hadn't kind of figured out that it was something magnetic, you know. And it was the weirdest thing, but it was a huge kind of revelation to me that I hadn't gone mad. I'd just been crossing and recrossing strong magnetic field lines that had been generated by this pyramid. And the pyramid itself is like I said, it's built on top of an aquifer, which I don't know if you're aware, but aquifers generate an electric charge. And it's actually nowadays how they find an aquifer. If they want to build a new city or a subdivision or something, they'll fly a plane over, look for an electric charge on the ground. If there's an electric charge on the ground, they know there's an aquifer under there, so they know there's a water source, so they know they can build a city there. It's not science fiction, it's science, you know. So this aquifer creates this kind of electric energy in the ground. Just the way it works is kind of interesting, Dave. It's basically, aquifers are holes in rocks, water running through these holes in rocks. And when you have water going from a kind of bigger hole into a smaller hole, it's put under enormous amounts of pressure, you know. And what happens is that basically the water kind of scrapes against the rock, and one of the electrons from the water molecule gets stripped away, you know, and left behind on the rock, which makes the rock negatively charged from the electron. And because the water has lost an electron, it becomes positively charged, and then you get this charge that flows between the two, the positive and the negative, and that generates this electric charge on the ground, you know. So there was something, I knew there was something kind of to do with an electromagnetic weirdness had gone on there. And I just kind of put that in the back of my mind, and I thought, well, I'll learn more about that when I can, you know. But we were on top of the pyramid. I said to Baba, I'm kind of upset, we need to boost. So down we went, you know. Went down through the jungle, and on the way back, it just seemed much easier. We get back to his village, we cuddle, goodbye, all the best, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I jump in the car and head off. And I still remember just kind of collapsing in the car that night, you know, and driving along the coast road with the villages kind of flashing by, desperate to tell someone, you know, I mean, desperate to tell someone what I just found out, you know, what I'd just seen, what I just experienced. And so I headed to the pub, because I was hopeful that I'd meet my old Hawaiian friend and tell him what had just gone on. And so I got there and I start relaying the story to this friend of mine. And what I realized quite quickly is that everyone in the bar is like it's just gone hushed, you know. I mean, nobody's talking and everybody's listening to us, you know. So I thought, oh, well, I'll carry on. I'll ham it up, you know. And so I just told him the whole story about the jungle, the weird dude with the AK-47, the walking on the cobbled streets, and then the pyramid itself, the crazy purple flashes and all that kind of stuff. And everybody at the end of it, and then I kind of say, and then we come back and I walked into the pub, and everybody at the end, everybody starts cheering and clapping and everything like that. So it was quite an adventure. Yeah.
What an excitement. Now you've gone there, you've seen this. And what year did this take place for you? This was 6 years ago. So what, 2011?
2012.
12. Okay. 2012.
Yep. In 2012. And literally that night I fell into bed so happy with myself. You know what I mean? It's like I did exactly what I came here to do. It was fantastic. Well, that night I had the worst nightmares. You know what I mean? Like, just terrifying nightmares, and in that weird kind of abstract way that nightmares terrify you, that nothing makes any sense, but it's all terrifying, you know. It's
right.
It just sounds nuts when you try and explain to someone why it was so scary, but it is. But it was. I had these terrible nightmares, and those nightmares didn't stop for months. You know, I mean, and so I think that's kind of what the Tapu curse was, or whatever it was. I had just absolutely terrible nightmares, and I could totally see how it would send people.
What were the nightmares? I mean, was there a specific storyline to these nightmares, or specific creatures, or something that you were encountering?
No, just complete randomness. Like, for instance, one was I was. I mean, nightmares don't sound scary when you say them out loud, but
right.
I was standing in this hallway, and everyone I knew went past me, and they were all going to this party, and I wasn't invited. And that was the first one. You know what I mean? And then I'm. Which doesn't sound scary, you know what I mean? And then an old flatmate kind of popped up and, you know, called me names, and it was just torture, you know what I mean? It was just unending torture, you know what I mean? A really kind of weird, weirdness. You know what I mean? None of it made any sense. You know, in actual fact, in the book, there's a nightmare in the book, and the editor made me change it to something that made more sense. You know, so the nightmare we describe in the book is not the nightmare as it actually happened. You know, because it just the one that actually happened made no sense and wasn't at all scary. So I kind of got back, and I was shattered and shell shocked, and kind of felt like I'd just been chewed up by this pyramid and spat out, you know. And but I couldn't let it go, you know. I mean, I couldn't give it up, you know what I mean? And so I just dug into all, I just gathered all the research, anyone that had ever been there, read anything I could read about it. And I'll just kind of jump into some of the research that I found. Does that sound good?
Yes, please do.
Yeah, okay. So,
I wonder one thing, if I could mention. Mm. I wonder if the curse was, if they considered it a curse because of the disturbances people would feel when they were there, not understanding and knowing that this was, even though it was kind of an advanced culture, obviously, not understanding where this disturbance was coming from. It would terrorize you. It would scramble your brain, bring about anxiety. I wonder if that's why they believe the ground to be cursed. Because we've learned through different ways, especially with the experiments with the God helmet, you know, that's been done by stimulating different parts of the brain with electromagnetic frequencies. It can cause hallucinations. It can cause discomfort, feelings of paranoia. So I wonder if that was part of the whole taboo of the deal, is that they thought that they had angered some god or some beings, and that was kind of their effect on them.
Yeah, I mean, I think because taboo is used sometimes to just prohibit people from going to, you know, don't go over there until Tuesday. There's a taboo there till Tuesday. You know what I mean? Things like that. So yeah, absolutely. I think you're bang on there. I think that's how the curse was. I believe it's a real physical thing that's happening there, and that's why you're not. That's why you're prohibited from going there, you know. Definitely. Although that said, in 2002 there was an expedition went from that was funded by the Heyerdahl Institute, which is Thor, you know, Thor Heyerdahl, the explorer Thor Heyerdahl.
Right.
It was his, the foundation he'd set up, funded this, and this was these modern archaeologists, super well funded, and they. They had government figures and church figures from all over the Pacific gathered, you know, to start this whole thing off. And they lifted the taboo on the pyramid while those guys were going to be working there, you know. So they did a set of prayer ceremony, and the thing was lifted. And so those guys, they were there for 6 years excavating the place, and they figured out how it was built, which was kind of in the three steps, but with a really interesting part when it comes to when the pyramid kind of interfaces with the ground. It's tabular basalt, which is kind of all the stones are put on end as opposed to on side. So the first layer that goes from the ground into the pyramid is all stones all standing up on end, which I'd never seen that before, you know. And they found that they were able to date the pyramid to construction starting around 700 AD. So it's much older than the star mounds or anything else that was around, you know, at that time. The other interesting thing they found was that they had this kind of, it's three steps, you know, so you have a big layer of basalt was the first step, and then the second step, another big layer of basalt, and then there is this like quite a deep, maybe like 3 feet deep, maybe I'm not too good at converting my centimeters to feet, but say 2 feet deep layer of sand, right? Which, and then on top of that is the final step of basalt. Now the archaeologist said that they thought that was basically sand that people had deposited from their feet. Now this thing is, you know, miles from the beach, and you walk through the jungle to get to it. So any sand that was on your feet is going to have kind of wiped off by then. But what struck me was that when you have that kind of layer of basalt, then sand, and then basalt, you have exactly what Wernher von Siemens built on top of the Great Pyramid, what you put together in the wine bottle on top of the Great Pyramid. You have a capacitor, a Leyden jar. You have the basalt that conducts electricity, the sand that doesn't conduct electricity, and then the basalt that conducts electricity. Again, you have a capacitor, you know. And that always really struck, that's always stuck with me, you know, that it just makes me, my gut tells me there's more to it than it's just an accident of sand falling off people's feet, you know. Anyway, the most intriguing find was that they had this, they could see that there was a continuity of activity around about the area up until about 150 AD, before the pyramid was built. And then there's no evidence for anybody around the area. In fact, right across Samoa, there's no evidence for anybody between 150 AD and 700 AD. It looks, if you were to rely on the evidence, it looks like there's no... The island's empty. You know what I mean? It looks like there's nobody living on the islands, which is really weird because that's not the typical story that you come to expect, you know? So it looks like there's some strange discontinuity. It looks like there was the original people on the island and then these other people arrive around about 750 AD and act in an entirely different way with an entirely new culture. And maybe I'll just jump and tell you a little bit about the accepted theory of migration into Samoa is that.
Well, yeah, but it is fascinating, right? That one culture is kind of there and then just gone, and another culture just overtakes it. Which, I mean, that's part of our history, right? I mean, kingdoms rise and fall, and people come in and take over that property and continue on. You know, I mean, it's totally still going on, yeah, with that exact same property, right? The owners that own that totally kingdom, yeah, and that property, yeah, fell, and the people have up, you know, there's been an uprising and they're trying to take the property back. So that is just cyclical in nature as part of it. Were there any strange markers or indications on this? You know, I mean, there's so many people look at the Mayan, the Aztec, and the Egyptian ruins and point to possible interactions with other beings that may have helped in building these,
yeah, you know, see, that's tombs. That's interesting, yeah,
right.
I just I would say that this thing is not built with the precision of the Great Pyramid, you know what I mean? And I can totally understand when someone looks at the Great Pyramid and they go, well, no human could build that, you know, because that thing's just a miracle, you know. But so this, There's, I mean, it's kind of rough basalt stones all piled up, but then you have the perfect alignment, which is stunning. There's weird energetics that are going on there, which is stunning. But to be honest, I mean, I didn't see any evidence of, you know, non-human activity. But who knows? Yeah. Who knows? I certainly didn't see it though.
So in wrapping up, kind of, what you found since locating this and what's gone on, is it now open? Are they doing more research there? Has it become, you know, obviously you found it. Other people have now done research there, so it's no longer this big hidden secret. But has anything really compelling come from all of this research?
Well, yeah, there is one. So in 2010, it's still ongoing. It's still illegal to go to the pyramid today. The UNESCO started the process to make it a World Heritage Site. Because if you consider, this is the largest ancient monument in the whole of Polynesia, and nobody knows about it, and nobody's protecting it, and nobody's looking after it. It's in a terrible state of affairs, right? That's still the state of affairs right now. UNESCO started the process and then said, no, it's way too complex. The social setup, the land dispute, we can't get involved, you know? And so they ended that process. But so basically in 2010, I didn't find out about this until much later. In 2010, it was when the locals were banned from the site, excavation was stopped, all that kind of stuff. Now, these two guys, Clark and de Biran, who were, they were funded by the Heyerdahl Institute as well, they said, well, we don't need to excavate. We'll just take a GPRS and we'll look inside the pyramid with, you know, radar, basically, and we'll be able to figure out if there's any interior chambers. And the reason that's important is the local villagers were saying that a 17th century chief of theirs was buried inside the pyramids, right? And so if these guys could find a chamber or even a body, then that would really strengthen the case of the local villagers to own the place, as opposed to the Nelson Corporation, the Swedish company. If there was no chambers inside, that kind of status quo, they keep owning it, right? So, I mean, 2010, these guys, Clark and DeBaron, go to the pyramid to use their GPRS machine, and the island is totally buzzing. I mean, all eyes are upon them. The results are really, really important, you know? And when they published their results, there was no internal chambers, no graves, and it was a big blow to the local villagers, but that wasn't the big news that came out in the research. What they found was that the magnetic field at Pulemelei is, you know, is wrong. It's not what it should be. So there's this thing that scientists use called the IGRF, the International Geomagnetic Reference Field, that tells you at any point on the planet, your magnetic field line should be at this angle and be this strong, you know? So they looked in their guidebook as they were setting up the machine, and it said it should be, you know, minus 13 degrees, but it wasn't minus 13 degrees. It was, they were experiencing it as being plus 10 degrees. So the way the magnetic field is kind of bending at Pulemelei, it changes the field by, you know, 23 degrees, which is absolutely huge. You know, it's a massive magnetic anomaly in this area, you know, and whether that's caused by the pyramid or whether that's why the pyramid was built there or whether it's just coincidence, you can only conjecture, you know. I'm pretty sure that it was all intentional, but how do you prove that, you know? But and the other, strangely, the fact that the magnetic field was all wrong was not the biggest news. The thing, what they discovered, Clark and DeBaron, was at the point where the ground and the pyramid meet, there's this thing called a pole reversal, which, like, if you take two magnets and you try and push them together and you feel them pushing apart, right? That's a pole reversal. That's exactly what's happening. And so what they discovered with their GPRS machine is that at the point where the pyramid meets the ground, at least at a molecular level, they push apart. The pyramid is kind of at a molecular level, it floats. You know, it's that's correct to say that it floats. Yeah.
What a remarkable find, and what a remarkable life. I mean, has this inspired you to go on the search and quest for other lost civilizations, other locations like this?
Yeah. So, well, this was, I was saying that in 6 years, my life has transformed. I mean, since I came back from Samoa, and it was just a really obsessed with it, you know, trying to figure out, nobody knows who built it. Well, somebody must know who built it, you know, and really kind of just spent the next 5 years, yeah, traveling the Pacific and going Micronesia, Polynesia, all around the islands, meeting people, learning their myths, because once there's no written history in the Pacific, you kind of need to dive into the myths and kind of trying to understand a picture of the pyramid culture that emerged in the Pacific. So that's kind of what I've been working on. And of course I wrote this book, so which was not in the plan in the first place. So I had to learn how to write a book, and that was, which was great. You know, I mean, I worked with this amazing editor, this guy, Peter Bloxham, and I'm so grateful to him for everything that he taught me, you know, on how to tell a ripping yarn, you know.
You've done a great job, Maya. And I thank you very much for coming on and sharing your story with our listeners. And, like I said, it's nice to kind of break away from the normal vein of the strange and the supernatural, but it's not without its twists and turns and bizarreness. I mean, gosh, you saw a green fog emit from the mouth of someone, and I know my listeners are going to beat me up and ask me why I didn't push more for that. What do you think now, in retrospect, all these years later, what do you think that was?
I mean, at the time, I thought it was meanness, vileness. She was being vile. She was really being horrible about somebody, you know what I mean? And she was just talking to someone else and being horrible about someone else. And that's what I thought it was at the time. Well, what do you think it is?
I haven't got an idea. I mean, it sounds like there was some kind of, knowing what we know and talk about in the paranormal, on the regular basis of this, it sounds more like a demonic manifestation that you just happen to notice. It could have been one of these discarnate energies, elementals, beings, whatever it is, that was moving maybe from one person into another or was being expelled from this person. And maybe that's why they were so vile and nasty, is that they had this thing festering inside them.
Wow. Wowee, Dave. That's awesome. I'd never thought of that. I mean, I thought it was just a little trick of the light and, you know. But yeah.
Nah, it's got to be aliens.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Thank you, Maya. Thank you so much. Thank you all for tuning in and joining us into our excursions into the unusual every week on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader, and you've been listening to Beyond the Darkness.